Hello, everybody. I'm Casey Pizzaglia, creator of Psyche Brown, and this is the About What Matters podcast. Thank you so much for joining us today and for joining us always and for supporting the brand. And we've revamped our YouTube and Instagram page, so keep your eyes on that. An interview that you'll hear today with former MLB player Richie Schaefer can be found on YouTube because we've been doing our interviews through Zoom. So you get to see me, see our guests, and I think it's an overall better experience. Having a show called About What Matters, I'd be remiss not to mention the pandemic that we're still in and the Black Lives Matter movement. It seems like people are starting to listen, and that's a step in the right direction. And as far as the pandemic goes, hopefully we're on the back half of that, but no one can say for sure. But hopefully the show can, ease things up a little bit. I hope you come back again and listen, check out the website. And I always appreciate you guys making time for us in your day. So thank you and enjoy.
Thanks for joining us, Richie Schaefer here. So how's the quarantine been going, man?
It's been good. It's been a weird kind of couple months for me because I was finishing my college degree after finishing baseball. So like I was commuting down to Clemson University twice a week. So the quarantine, when that hit, it sort of shut campus down. So it just transferred everything online to me. So kind of helped because I didn't have to like drive 2.5 hours every day or every week down there. So I get to finish my degree online, which was actually awesome. And then I'm trying to figure out kind of what comes next, but it's been crazy being cooped up. How about you?
Are you in South Carolina? Is that where you're at?
North Carolina, Charlotte.
Supposed to go down right before the quarantine hit. I was going to go cover the ACC tournament.
Okay.
It was in Greensboro.
And yeah.
It's like the day before, they canceled it.
I know. I know. Crazy.
So it was, while we're on the college subject, when you were in college, were you doing, right now you're working on short stories. I read some of them last night.
Okay.
And we have a book coming out, I believe.
Right, correct. Yep.
So when you were in college, was it something that you knew you wanted to do post-baseball?
No.
Writing?
Writing is something that I just kind of picked up a couple years ago. It was near the tail end of my career. I needed something that was completely off my radar. I needed something that was so at the back end of my career, I sort of saw the writing on the wall. Things weren't going as well as I would have liked. I kind of saw that it was just a lot more stressful because it wasn't trending upwards anymore. I was sort of hanging on. So I needed something that was a stress relief, something that was therapeutic outlet. That was something that was completely off my radar, something that was just way out of my normal systems for every day. And I've always kind of been a storyteller, joking around with my buddies and stuff. And I had this idea that I've had for a long time in my head. And then a good buddy of mine in the Cleveland organization, Eric Stamets, who's trying to carve out, a utility infield role with the Indians right now. He turned me on to a sci-fi series called Red Rising by Pierce Brown. And I wasn't a big reader, and I read it and fell in love with it. And I was I've never read a story like that. I didn't know these types of things, these stories existed. I feel I want to write something similar to this. This is something that, as a 28-year-old jock who likes action movies and all kinds of stuff like that, still has some intellectual side. I felt like that was something that resonated with me. It's hey, I want to try something like this. So I wrote the first 10 pages of it and gave it to him, who was a big reader. And he was like, it's pretty good, man. You should keep going. So I just sort of started doing it after every game as a decompression therapeutic thing without really much thought about it. And then I looked up about a year and a half later and I had a 420 page novel written. I was like, oh my God. So now the tough part has been the last year and a half trying to edit it and polish it up and get it ready for publication. But
so, have you sought out any editors to look
at? I got a professional editor. I hired a freelance editor for it, and she did a great job and sent me back a 65-page report on my book. And so it's been taking me a long time to thumb through all that. And then I just hired a professional cover design studio for all of it. So it's gonna be cool, man. I'm really excited about it. So I just got to actually do it. It's just been,
I've worked in the newspaper business for the last 5 years, and it's always nice to have another set of eyes look at it, your work.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Last couple of years, you were bounced doing a little bit in the minors. I can imagine it was a nice thing to go to when you get back to the hotel room or whatever to have the writing to do.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I the problem was I was going back to the hotel every night and I was just watching hours of video of swings and stuff. And I was just like, oh man, what can I do to like get myself? I was just obsessing over it. And it was really bad mentally for me. And I was just getting to the point where I was like, I need to make a change or else I'm going to like spiral into some, you know, dark pit I'm never going to get out of, because it's just getting like, I worked my whole life towards this and I felt like things were, it was getting to the point where I was like not loving baseball anymore because I was so obsessed with trying to like maximize this, you know, opportunity. And I think I would finish the game and I'd come home and immediately start working on like the next part of this story. And it got me out of my head of baseball and into some other world that was a good escape and something that helped me cleanse and decompress for the day. So I wasn't just sitting there stressing over an 0-for-4 or something like that. Yeah. That just led into another bad day and another bad day. So I think it was really healthy for me. And I also found something that I love that I would have maybe never really experienced without it.
Well, you've accomplished more than 99.9% of baseball players. So baseball is just it's such a mental game. I hit like 200 in college. Yeah. So I totally hear you stressing out and, you know, 0-for-4 is driving you crazy.
Yeah.
So do we have a target date for the fiction book?
So I've set the date for myself. I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to hit it or not. Like August 1st is when I'd like to have it, everything completed and be able to like go out. I don't know if I'm going to be able to get there or not. I'm going to try my best. I think like I'd rather set a deadline that's going to make me press than one too far in the future. They're like, I got time. But I'm going to really try. I still have like some edits and rewrites and little things I have to do right there. And then eventually, once I actually get all those edits done with the story, I'll probably have to send it to like a copy editor just to make sure, like, because I wasn't an English major. My grammar is like,
I read the, the Booth story last night and I thought it was pretty tight grammatically. So.
Oh, thanks. Okay, cool. So that's something that like I don't know if it is or not. Like, I'll take your word for it, but yeah. I do my best and I'm like, God, I think this is right. I don't know. We'll see. But
so I want to get to some of the beginning parts of your baseball career in a little bit. But so last year you played in the Atlantic League, right? Yep. You hit 27 right. jacks. What was the process of saying, was it the coronavirus or was it like, you know, did you know before that you were like, you know what, I'm going to retire?
So it was the moment the season ended, I knew. The way I looked at it was like the Atlantic League and independent ball was like my last hurrah. Like, I'm giving it one more shot. Mm-hmm. And if no one wants me, then I'm just going to hang him up. Cause like you said, I hit 27 home runs. I only like 106 or 107 games. So like per game wise, I mean, if you stretch that out to 100, I mean, that's a 45 home run type season in a major league. I did exactly what I was supposed to do. Right. And still no one wanted me. I got no offers or anything. So I'm like, you know what? Like, I feel like I was chasing my tail, you know, just going in circles for, you know, it was one of those things where realistically, I mean, I'm not going to sit here and complain about money. Obviously I'm super blessed where I got drafted and that kind of stuff. But I mean, realistically I hadn't made a salary in 3 years up until that point. I mean, I was making, you know,
minor league money, which
8 grand a year, 10 grand a year. And, you know, I'd been very smart and fiscally responsible with like my signing bonus. But like, I realized at some point I was like, listen, man, like being away all the time, just the stress I was putting my body through. Mm-hmm. It just sort of culminated that like, I got to the point where I was like, listen, like I don't know if the big leagues is something that's even going to be on my radar anymore. And that's sort of why, you know, everyone does it, is to pursue the major leagues. That's their mm-hmm. dream. And I got, and it was pretty much like almost halfway, maybe 3/4 of the way through the independent league season there, where I kind of decided this was going to be it. And I was like, you know what, like, let's just play this out for the love of the game, my last hurrah to play and enjoy being out here. Because it is something that I truly love. I love baseball and I'm so grateful for my career. But I will say, when on the back end of my affiliated career, it was very much like I wasn't enjoying it as much because I was so like obsessed with trying to get back to the major leagues. I wasn't enjoying the fact that I was playing a game every day, and I lost some of that insight and that's perspective.
Is that kind of like once you taste it,
you. Oh my God. Yes, absolutely. So actually, yeah, if you read some of the like stories, I have one story on there about greatness and defining greatness and stuff like that. And it's sort of about that journey that I went through at the back end of my career, where it's like, I got a taste of the major leagues and how it just changed and almost ruined the rest of my experience, because it was like, when you're in the minor leagues, before you get there, that the major leagues is like this abstract thing, right? It doesn't even feel like you're playing the same sport sometimes as the major leaguers. Like you're still playing baseball, but you're in double A, you feel like you're on another planet. It doesn't even feel like the major leagues is obtainable. And all of a sudden you get there and you realize that it's not that far away. And now you come like obsessed with this. It's almost like this drug. Once you get a taste of it, you cannot like get it out of your head.
Of course. Yeah.
And it really ruined my perspective on a lot of things, because number one, I realized that getting to the major leagues in general, there's so many things have to align correctly. It's not just about playing well. You know what I mean? It's about playing well at the right time, in the right organization, at the right position, and doing all of these things sort of timing wise as well. And I realized that quickly in 2017, when I essentially made it to big leagues and then got DFA'd the next year and kind of this dip down. I was like, had this resurgent season in 2017 where I had 30 home runs with Cleveland. I led the league. I was the MVP of the All-Star game and AAA and all these things, and didn't get called up in September. And that's when it sort of hit me that like,
doesn't matter what I do.
Yes. Like I wasn't in complete control of what happened. I was very fortunate to get to the major leagues. Even when I did, I mean, I definitely hit my way there. I definitely earned it that season, but like there were certainly things along the way that contributed to that were out of my control. And I think that's when the first inkling of that sort of settled in, but it didn't really start to hit me until independent ball. When I was playing, I did basically everything I needed to do again. And people just were, you know, sort of like, okay, like they moved on. I think that helped me look back on my career in a more positive light at the accomplishments, instead of focusing on some of the negative things, because you realize that, you know, I worked my butt off every single day. I never like slacked. I did all the things I was in my control that I was supposed to do. And sometimes if the dominoes don't fall in the exact way that you did, then that's okay, because you still got to experience some incredible things.
So there's so much happening right now in the minor leagues, uncertainty, as if they might cut some teams next year, take their affiliations away. And the wages have already been a problem for the last, you know, X amount of years.
Right.
What were some of the things, the biggest differences between traveling with High Point last year as to the affiliated ball and then to big leagues?
From affiliate, like from the independent ball, the big leagues, or independent ball and like the minor leagues?
I think to both. What's the difference?
The major leagues in indie ball is like the difference between being a billionaire and being homeless, you know what I mean? In terms of like the difference in lifestyle is so dramatic that they're not even on the same caliber. I mean, the major leagues, it's mandated. The players union, you have to stay at 5-star hotels on the road. You have to have certain accommodations with flights. I mean, you have to do all these things. Like the food has to be this gourmet, certain standard, organic, all these types of things. And then indie ball, like, and it's nothing against indie ball, it's just the budget you have to do. And that's what a part of it. You know, we ate at Sheet's gas station probably 3 times a week. You know what I mean? Because that's where you were going and stuff. And it's like you eating hot dogs and like the microwave burritos and stuff like that. You're on one bus with 40 dudes. And it's like, and I think that you truly have to love what you're doing to like do all those things. And in terms of the minor leagues, I would say that independent ball is very, very, very similar to the lower levels in the minor leagues in terms of the accommodations and, some of those things. In terms of the major leagues versus independent ball, and even the major leagues versus the very, very low levels of the minor leagues, I mean, it is an entirely different world. And it's very, like, you're sort of awestruck just at the lifestyle difference.
I think that's something that they're trying to figure out, because, like, you're a first round draft pick. You come from Clemson, where you have the best facilities. You know, you're getting treated very well at Clemson. And then they make a significant investment in a first round pick.
Right.
And then they send you to low A ball, where you guys are traveling like on buses they need to take care of their investment more. So I feel like that's if they're trying to like maybe condense the minor leagues into a smaller sample size of teams and then provide a better lifestyle.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think you're spot on with that. The only issue is that baseball, I think it's so incredibly difficult to project baseball players because the game is so mental. There's so much you can't see, like on the field, there's just so much that goes into it. And there's so much development and uncertainty that it's really hard to project baseball players. That's why you see these guys that are, you know, I mean, I think of a guy that I play with, Kevin Kiermaier, who was drafted in like, you know, 40th round, and he's a platinum glove winner, and, you know, made $50 million in his career. He's a phenomenal player. In today's game, what they're trying to do right now is Kevin Kiermaier wouldn't even had an opportunity to even be anywhere on any field. You know what I mean? So I think there's so many, and I think that's very different than other sports. I don't think you see that many players sort of slip through the cracks in the amateur draft process in other major sports turn out to be very successful, you know, major league players at in their respective sport. And I think it's because baseball more than every other sport, maybe hockey, but baseball is such a skill oriented sport. I mean, you don't have to be like in basketball, you know, if you're 7'4" and you have any semblance of athleticism, you're going to be pretty decent as a center in basketball. It's just pure size and numbers game. With baseball, it's like you can be the biggest, fastest, strongest guy, but that doesn't mean that
you can hit.
It doesn't mean you can hit. It doesn't mean that you can feel. It doesn't mean you can pitch. It doesn't mean you, like, there's very specific skill set that's involved. And I think it takes a long time to develop that skill set to a major league caliber level. And you just never know what's going to happen in the years from when you're, you know, 17 years old till when you're 24 years old in that time frame to figure out, like, who's going to be the guys that's going to be stick out and who's not. But yeah, I definitely think that they need to figure out a way. And here's the thing, that realistically, they can do it. They can make minor league standards better. They can do it. It's just, I think baseball's become, or major like professional sports in general, have just become so profitable and so lucrative of an investment for owners and stuff like that, that their profit margins, the easy place to cut profit margins in the minor leagues. The problem is what they don't realize is that their major league product comes from their minor league product. So it's like, I don't know. It's they're sort of cutting off their nose to spite their face if you're treating minor leaguers horribly, because this is the next generation of their product, and for their product to stay profitable in the long term, they have to make a sizable investment in the minor leagues, and how it is.
They were cutting off, some organizations cut off the payment during the coronavirus, and it's like, how do you expect these guys to? It's not a lot of money to begin with, and then you're gonna not give it to them right now. It's crazy.
Yeah, so I have a friend in the Brewers organization, and he told me that literally every single minor league free agent in their entire organization got released. Every single every somewhat redundant, like 90% of their minor league staff got let go because they're just not going to have a season, like all these things. So it's like, I get you're trying to save some money during a time where realistically there's not any revenue coming in, but you got to look at like, how much are you just gutting your entire system? Because things are going to come back to normal the next year, hopefully. And now you've lost like your entire coaching staff. You're going to have a brand new system with all new people who don't understand what's going on. You're going to have to get a brand new organization. You're going to have to refill all these spots and stuff. So I don't know. It's a really interesting thing going on right now. And that's the one issue I have as a guy who spent more time in the minor leagues than the major leagues. When I look at the players union and the fight they're having, is the biggest fight I think they have right now is for like the top percent of players, where, you know, realistically the bubble guys, the major league bubble guys, the 4A type dudes, the guys are going to be fill out the rest of the roster, not your 2, 3, 4 hitters that are in the lineup every day, but the remaining pieces of this roster are going to be the guys that are going to be affected the most. And what they don't even see is all the minor league careers that are essentially wiped out. Like, what happens to all these kids that just got drafted yesterday, right? Like, are they just going to go and hang out in Arizona and do some like social distant, like front toss for 3 months and never play? Like, so I don't know. It's an interesting concept right now. And I don't sure what the solution is, but I don't think the solution is decimating your minor league team, especially your future.
Well, yeah, they also, I mean, think about how many people aren't going to have the satisfaction of being drafted this year. They went from 40 rounds to 5.
Yep. 100%.
That's incredible. 100%. In 2009, you were drafted in the 25th round.
Right.
Did you know that was going to happen at that point? You didn't obviously take it, but.
Yeah. So what happened? So in 2009, the draft was a lot different than it is now. This was like two CBAs prior to this. It was a lot more, there was just a lot more gunslinging going around. So like kind of the free for all in terms of what you could do. So there was a lot of pre-draft negotiations that went on. So I actually turned down a first round draft pick by the Cincinnati Reds in 2009. I had set a number in which I deemed was the value of my college education. And I said, hey, if you guys can get here, then I'm willing to go. And if you can't, then I'm not. And the Reds called and they just basically, you know, said, hey, listen, like how firm are you on that? I'm like, very firm. They're like, okay, if we take you at pick 15, we give you this, you're not going to take it. I said, no, like my number is this. And so they said, okay. And so basically when I turned that down, I essentially had priced myself above
the market.
People thought, yeah, what my value was. But the way I looked at it was like, that is what I deemed the value of my college education and college, you know, career path was going to be. And it ended up working out because
you bet on yourself. Essentially.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, I was like, listen, like this is, I think I'm going to go here and get bigger, stronger and better. I'm going to get, you know, drafted at where I think I am going to be, you know, more valuable. So when I actually got drafted in the 25th round, I didn't really expect to get picked up again. I think the Dodgers just took a flyer and said, hey, you know, maybe he changed his mind, you know, like we'll see. And I remember the area scout calling me and he's like, hey, Rich, like Dodgers drafted you.
You're a Dodger.
I'm like, hey, man, like, listen, Don, you know the deal. And he's like, well, let's not jump to – I'm like, come on. Like, so unless you can offer me first-round money in the 25th round, like, I don't think it's going to happen. But so, yeah, I kind of knew, like, I was very, very strongly committed to go to school. It was something that was important to me. But, I mean, I could have been persuaded. I just didn't get that offer.
Then in 2012, were you prepared for – did you kind of like know, did you have an agent and know what was going to happen going into that draft?
Sort of, but it didn't play out at all like we had planned. So the 2012, that draft was the start of the new draft. Like what the draft is now in 2012 was the first year of that with like very hard slotted systems, certain like compensation stuff, like, you know, with draft picks and compensation picks and all this kind of stuff. So teams were very cautious on how they were doing things because they had this pool of money that they had to work within.
It was like guaranteed.
It wasn't the Red Sox were like, you know, it wasn't like, you know, the Red Sox in prior years would draft, you know, six guys over the course of six rounds and all give them $2 million a piece. And they just couldn't do that anymore. So a lot of teams were very hesitant on how they were working with things. And basically they convinced a lot of high school kids to take, take sort of deals to get drafted higher up. And I sort of stayed pretty steadfast in what I did. So I fell a little bit, or we were projected like somewhere in the early teens in there. And I fell to 25, which, I mean, I'm not, like I said, not complaining at all.
Of course.
But I think what ended up happening was a lot of teams didn't really know how to approach the new draft. And so we had a game plan going into it, but that was sort of, when I found out I got drafted, it was on TV, just like my agent, the same
way. Wow.
I didn't have anything ahead of that. So he would call me like, hey, you know, possibly the White Sox here at this thing. Like, I didn't work. Hey, maybe the Blue Jays here, like whatever. Like, I'm hearing some things. And then I didn't hear anything. And all of a sudden my name spit out. I was like, oh, all right, cool, man. Like, let's go.
That's cool. That's awesome.
Yeah.
So eventually you get up to Tampa pretty quickly. August 3rd, 2015. All right, 2015?
Yep.
First at bat, you get hit by a pitch by Jose Quintana.
Right.
I don't know how many other people have been hit by a pitch in their first at bat.
It's not that many. I mean, yeah, rare company. Yeah. So a little cutter off the shin. It's so funny. You have so much adrenaline going in that moment that I barely felt it. I'm talking barely. I mean, it's like, I thought I hit my pant leg or something. I woke up the next day, my shin was like, I had a golf ball, like a huge
adrenaline, man.
Huge lump. I didn't even feel it. I didn't even think I got hit that hard, but I got drilled. It's funny. I like to joke around and say that was sort of like a metaphor for my entire career. Like basically, like we get my first like opportunity and I get drilled. It's like, well, you got on base and that's great, but it kind of hurt.
Yeah.
And you know, you didn't really get a hit, but you also got on base. That's kind of cool. So it just is like little anomaly of an at bat for kind of an anomaly of a career was what I had.
What was the call like when they told you you're getting the call?
It was awesome. Yeah, it's incredible. I mean, it's everything you could dream of. I'd worked my entire life since I was, you know, 4 years old to get to that moment. And I just remember sitting in the clubhouse in Durham and nothing, I didn't feel different. I didn't feel anything, but I just like, just packing up. I don't think it really hit me until I was like, I was even in Chicago, like in the clubhouse still. I don't think it hit me until I actually like walked out onto the field when I got dressed and went out for BP that day. I think that was when it finally hit me that like, cause it's really interesting. Like this, one of the biggest jumps that you have to make from going to the minor leagues to the major leagues is playing in stadiums that are three times the size.
Yeah.
And you don't really think about it, but it changes like changes the heights of the lights. It changes your depth perception. You're used to like these like sort of low sitting, like sort of open outfield type mm-hmm. of things. And all of a sudden now you've got this like every, like, I remember, I'll never forget one of my biggest, like all moments, the biggest, I'm in Texas playing the outfield for the, basically the first time in my career. I had like lied to them and said I played a ton.
Yeah,
of
you were all over the place. So I looked at
yeah,
you.
Yeah. I never played the outfield. Like you play right field, right? I was like, yeah, totally. And so like, all right, you're in. I'm like, yeah, let's go. I never played the outfield, but I was wanting to get in there.
You want to get in.
Yeah. So I'm in right field in Texas and the old stadium, not the one they just built obviously, but, and in right field, they have like the scoreboard is, you know, 100 feet up in the air directly behind you. So I remember like, I'm like kind of freaking out a little bit. I don't know where I should be playing. I'm looking at KK. He's like, tell me where to go. And then they would say a name. I didn't hear it because I wasn't paying attention. I'm trying to figure out like who's hitting. I'm looking like straight up. I'm like, God. And then I remember sitting for a second and just like looking. I remember like looking, I'm like looking up like this. I'm still seeing seats. And you're just like, I don't know why that was at one of those all moments where you're like, I'm looking so high and I still see seats. Like, I don't understand how this place is so big. That's one of the moments that you feel like you're actually in the major leagues. Cause that's like a really big difference between the major leagues and the minor leagues is just how insanely big these stadiums are and how you feel like so small in them. You know what I mean?
First hit is probably a real big deal.
Yeah, it was awesome. First hit being a home run was really cool.
Yeah.
It was, you know, it was funny. I talked about this a lot where I was that game, Chris Sale was starting and I just got dominated. Like my first at bat, I was just out of control. I was not like, I was, the gears were spinning really quick upstairs. And I remember coming in and settling myself down and then having some good at-bats leading up to that. I sort of felt myself kind of getting back in the groove of things. And they brought Daniel Webb in, a righty. And I was like way better against righties that year than lefties anyway, even though I was right-handed.
Yeah.
And I sort of knew going in like, okay, like this is going to be like, I feel like I wasn't feeling a home run, but like, I was like, this is going to be, I'm getting my hit right here. And then I ended up putting a nice swing on the ball and in Chicago, the bulb was pretty well to right field and goes out. And so it was just such an incredible experience and something that like, I look back on the video and I'm like cheesing, like smiling right on the bases. I'm like, but I couldn't help myself. I was just so pumped, man. It was just such a cool experience. Something I worked so hard for. So yeah.
Yeah. I'm sure everyone, there was some vets on that team. I'm sure everyone was pretty happy for you.
Absolutely. Yeah. So we had a great group of guys and guys that treated me really well. So it was awesome.
And you guys were kind of in the playoff race there too, like right around 500, mm-hmm. you know,
yeah,
right
yeah.
in it. Who's the toughest pitcher you faced in your MLB career?
Oof. So I unfortunately was tasked with like pinch hitting against like all the best
tough lefties. Closers.
Oh my God, that was my entire job. I'm like, guys, give me a chance to like give me some chance to like compete. What are we doing here? Like, so like Andrew Miller dominated me.
Oh, big lefty.
Oh my God, just dominated me. Like he would just throw these sliders that would go like around the left-handed batter's box somehow and like end up right down the on his, you just give up on him immediately.
When he's landing halfway to the play, you know what I mean?
And he would toy with you too. He would throw the first fastball like 91, 92 and you're like,
oh, I got this.
I thought he threw harder, right? And then you get to like 2-2 and he throw 98 at your chin. You're like, wait, what? Where did that come from, man? So like, he was impossible to hit. Zach Britton was ridiculous. A reliever for the Orioles, Michael Givens.
He's like kind of wild righty.
Oh my gosh, wild righty throwing. Basically, he's like the opposite of Andrew Miller. He would throw from like way over here. Yeah. The ball, he's throwing 98. He was like do this thing like Johnny Cueto style. He'd like turn his back a little bit and then like let it rip. So he like hides the ball really well. That's one of the quickest strikeouts I've ever had in my life. I think the bat lasted about 15 seconds. Oh my God.
Yep. See you guys later.
All right. See you later. Trying to think who else. Craig Kimbrel. I feel like the majority of my bats were against these like back end relievers that are supposed to strike everyone out anyway. Yeah. And I was like a high strikeout guy. So I was like, okay. So I was, I had some success against some decent guys though.
Oh, totally, man.
When I started, I was okay. I was not going to pinch hitter. I was not going to pinch hitter at all.
So I'm not going to keep you here too much longer.
Oh, no, you're good. I'm not doing anything.
What compared to what you played in the independent league last year? What is like the closest comparison to talent level at the Atlantic League?
It's really interesting. I would say the Atlantic League has like a really wide range, right? I think there is a ton of major league talent in the Atlantic League, and I honestly mean that. There's plenty of guys like we talked about in terms of like timing that like had their career just went just a little bit this way instead of this way. They could have easily been in the big leagues. I mean,
yeah, Matt Latos, I saw him play last year.
Yeah. So, I mean, Latos is there. I mean, our starting lineup at High Point in the Atlantic League, like 7 of the 9 guys had big league experience. At one point, at least, a lot of guys kind of went different ways, something like that. But I would say, I think you have a wide range. I think you've got at the top end, I think you've got maybe like 5 to 10% of guys have like major league skill set. And then you've got like a big chunk of guys who could easily be everyday triple A players. And then you've got a big majority, I would say, are probably like double A level. And then you have some of them like you're filling guys that are like your low
lifetime minor leaguer,
single A, yeah, like low A, single A kind of guys. And then there's also this, because the independent leagues don't have like a filler system like the big leagues do, like the minor leagues, where like if some guy gets hurt, they just got to come on and fill in right away. You do have guys that get picked up that are just like local, like, hey, we need a body right now. And there's guys that get picked up, and those guys are always great. We always love them.
Oh, for sure.
But it's like, yeah, so you have a very wide range. You'd have guys like, you know, Matt Latos, who's a, you know, 10-year big leaguer, and then you got a guy who like maybe hasn't played baseball in like 3 or 4 years, but he's still like in good shape, and he was just here, like he was local at the weekend. We like desperately need a third position player on the bench, like just for emergencies, like just in case. And he's a solid player. He probably like played college ball and just hasn't, you know, played professional baseball at any point, and so he's like hangs out on the weekend with us. So it's a huge range. But the one thing I will say that I'm very glad that I played independent ball is because I do think that there's so much that affiliated baseball can learn from independent baseball, because there is this sense of guys playing for just loving the game. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? There's plenty of guys there that I'm not 100% convinced that they're even trying to get back to affiliated baseball. It's just like, hey, my body can still play baseball without breaking, and I want to do that until I basically cannot any longer. I'll figure out, I got my whole life to like work and do stuff or whatever. I just want to play baseball because I love it so much. And I think that sense of like purity, like really injected more fun back into baseball for me. At least that's the way I look at it. A much, much like healthier perspective on the game.
Because I can imagine there's a lot of, I know how baseball can be for your mind, and I imagine there's a lot of anxiety in the affiliated ball and
oh yeah,
you know, feeling like the only way you're gonna reach you're that close and like I gotta reach the ultimate goal.
Yeah,
like anything else won't be satisfying, you know.
No, 100%. I mean, I think this is something that I think more teams are realizing and they're trying to put some stress on, but it's a topic in general that I think as a society, we struggle with, and we're getting better at it, but just mental health in general in baseball is really bad. It's like a really, really bad issue in baseball. And it's because there was this, I remember reading this study, I think it was like Harvard did it, or so it was some Ivy League school did it. That basically humans, they won't actively choose to do tasks that there's not at least like a 65% success rate at. And you look at hitting, the very best hitters in the world have like a 30% success rate. So it's really not like hitting's not a task that the human brain is like even equipped to handle. And that's like at an actually biological level that like hitting will like break your mind. So it's like realistically, I think teams are investing in like mental skills coaches and stuff like that to like help guys mentally understand like what success looks like in baseball, especially on the hitter side, because you're right, there is a ton of anxiety and issues with stress and stuff like that in baseball, just because of the nature of what success looks like in the game.
Are you getting the texts from your boys telling you, asking you to come back, or you know, unretire, come back and play.
Oh, yeah. I definitely get that. A good bit. Some guys will be like, bro, go for it. Do it, man. And I've actually thought, I mean, honestly, through quarantine, I thought about it because I'm like, hey, this might have been the perfect opportunity for me. Like, I didn't miss anything. Everyone's not playing. Maybe this is like, I got a chance just to
even playing fielder.
Yeah, right. I got a chance to actually like, go finish my degree and not miss anything of baseball related and come right back and go for it. But I don't know, man. It's another big reason I left is strictly because it's just a tough lifestyle in terms of being gone. I mean, I'm married for about 5 years, and I'm gone from my wife 7 months out of the year. I see her,
it's tough, man,
you know, every 4 weeks on the weekend or something. It's just like, that gets really, really exhausting and tiring. You're always in when I was in High Point, I lived in a hotel. Like, that was my home at home. I lived in a hotel. So I was in a hotel at home, and I was in a hotel on the road too. So I lived in a suitcase, didn't have a kitchen or anything. So I was always eating food on the road. I was eating out. It just like, it just gets to be a really exhausting lifestyle, even for how incredible it is to like play baseball for a living. Like, that part's the best. The rest of it just gets really taxing. And it just, there comes a point where you just are like, you know what? Like, I'm glad I did it. It was a ton of fun, but it's time to like, have a more, you know, stable life. Yes.
Well, you'll be able to have like all these different chapters.
For sure. Yeah. No doubt.
Tampa Bay fans get a bad rap. Or not a bad rap, but like, you know, right. Sometimes there's not a huge showing.
Right.
What are your thoughts on Rays fans?
So I think the Rays, I mean, I think the Tampa Bay area has, I think they've proven that they have enough people for a fan base. You look at the Tampa Bay Lightning, those guys sell out all the time. It's strictly the stadium location. It's just in a bad area. If you look at like, it's in St. Petersburg, not necessarily, it's in St. Pete, not Tampa. And so for all of the highly populated area of Tampa to get to St. Pete, they get across this bridge that's like a nightmare to cross, even not during rush hour, but the weekday games especially, you got to drive through rush hour across this bridge to get to the game on time. You got to turn around. You got to drive 45 minutes back across this bridge. It's just not in a good area in terms of being accessible to fans.
They work at 5 and then like,
say, yes, tough. Yeah. Right. So, I mean, I think that's the major issue. And then realistically, I mean, the stadium itself is just not appealing. Like, you're going to drive an hour to go to a place and go sit in the trop, and then you're like, God, this place is hideous. You know what I mean? Like, it's, I mean, like, listen, I played there and I love it and it was great, but like, let's call a spade a spade. I mean, there's just,
even on television, I don't like watching games on television when it's at the
it's
drop.
It's tough. So I mean, that's the real issue. I think if it was in somewhere in the heart of Tampa and not St. Pete, that it would do really well. I think it would thrive, because realistically, if you think about the St. Pete side is a little more of the retirement community side.
Yeah, that's what the joke always is.
Yeah, but I mean, that's like the more retired community side. But you got to think about it, if those guys retire, they're not working jobs and they have the ability to like leave before rush hour starts to get, I think you'd have more people commute from St. Pete to Tampa than Tampa to St. Pete to do that. So I think they need to do it. Obviously, the owners are very concerned about, you know, profit and money, so that's the biggest issue. But I hope they don't do the Montreal split. I'm not sure if they're doing that.
Yeah, I read about that last year. It's tough life, man.
Yeah, I hope they don't do that. So,
where's your favorite place to play?
Oof. Playing at Fenway, it was incredible.
And you went yard there too, right?
I did. Yeah, that was awesome. Yeah, so I had a home run there, the Green Monster. I mean, I think it's so incredible because you know the history that's been on that field. You know what I mean? There's a lot of these new stadiums out there that you lose a little bit of that. Like when I'm standing at, you know, third base, I think of like all the different, you know, Red Sox legends and all the people from baseball history that have stood at that exact same base that I'm standing on. You know what I mean? I think that's really incredible. And just, I mean, the Red Sox can be 20 games out of first place and it still sells out. So it's just a really incredible place. And then probably my other favorite place was Toronto. Just because they've got a rabid fan base when they're playing well.
Yeah.
Gosh, I mean, it is like, and they closed the dome in the Rogers Center. It is like, so I play, I mean, when I was playing them, that was in the heart of their like really good teams with like Encarnacion, Jose Bautista, Josh Donaldson. I mean, those teams were stacked. So, I mean, those fans came out in droves. I mean, I think at one point we played them late September and they had like 53,000 or something. And it was just like playing in front of that is like, that's a whole nother level of
adrenaline.
Oh yeah, for sure. That was the biggest crowd I ever played in front of. So I would say those are amazing. Yankee Stadium is a cathedral. Things incredible. So yeah, I mean, it's there's not many places where you're not like, this place is awesome.
Except any experiences with hecklers in New York or Boston?
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah, of course. Absolutely. But I mean, that's just part of it.
Part of it goes with it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Probably in the minors too, I imagine.
Oh yeah. I mean, that's everywhere you go. And hecklers never really got to me. I always like to have fun with them.
Yeah.
I think the easiest way I've learned the easiest way to diffuse hecklers is just agree with everything they say. They don't they're like, you suck. I'm like, yeah, I know. And they're like, no, but you suck. I'm like, yeah, no, I know. I'm not any good. Like, I know that. He's like, you're never getting back to the big leagues. I'm like, probably not, man. Like, I don't, you know, like, they expect you to fight back. And if you don't, they don't really know what else to say. And they're like, this isn't fun. Like, this guy's just sad. I don't want to make fun of anyone. Like,
well, at least you were in the outfield.
Yeah.
All right, man. So thanks for giving all the stories about MLB. And keep me posted on when the book comes out. If anything I can do to help you out, I'd be happy to do it, man.
Absolutely, man. Of course. Thank you.
All right. Richard Schaefer, where can everyone find you at?
On Twitter, it's at rshaef8, R-S-H-A-F-F-8. On Instagram, it's DickieDanger8. That's like my Twitch personality. I stream on Twitch.
Oh, yeah, I wanted to ask you about that.
I stream on Twitch every Monday, Wednesday, Friday, 11 a.m. My little alter ego, DickieDanger.
It's on your Wikipedia page, I think.
Yeah. So, is that, and then my author website is schaeferstories.com. Yes. If you want to check that out, please go check them out. I'd appreciate it. It's gonna be it.
I appreciate it, Richie. Thank you, man. Good luck with everything, and keep me posted. All right,
absolutely. Take care, man.
All right, later, bud.
See you, bud.